I am unashamed. What about you?
Go the normal way. And so it's affectionately, you're fools, but you're laughing all the way to the bank. Oh, it's kind of funny, you know, because they're like, well, that's crazy. You don't. I mean, because they do stuff that normal stock people don't do. It's like, if you have a winner, you just keep buying it. Now, even when it's high,
your little sheet you had to show me? So, Dad, here's what I'm doing. Show me that sheet. Let me just
pontificate. I showed him my whiteboard. Yeah, this is my stock whiteboard. What does that mean? I don't know. Can you see this?
Yeah, you can see
it. Get a shot of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what do you call that in the computer world, the stock market world? That's your what?
This is my whiteboard.
Whiteboard,
yeah, for my.
You know, like Carl Rowe.
I check these. These
Carl
are ones
Rowe
I'm
with a little whiteboard.
In
he writes all this stuff.
That's Jace, just, yeah. You are in there. I know you're my son because you look like me too much. But I'm looking at that.
I'm glad that's.
I'm fixed to get.
I don't know where the gene was that put that in your head, but I don't know Robertson.
I'm fixed to darken up my beard. Look, I was driving down here and some, you know, get her done said, "Hey, Phil," as I went by, and I thought. Boy, that's bad.
You know, hey, I looked at Miss K gave me a picture, and there was four of us in the duck blind in 1972. And it was me, Big Al Bowling, Kenneth Greenfield, and Hookin' Bull Thompson. Four of us. We were in that blind just leaning over the blind. And I think Gary Stevenson shot that. It was just early stages there. I don't know who shot it. But anyway, I haven't seen a picture of the four guys the three guys I ran with until that picture. But I looked at me and I said, well, good night. I look like Jeff.
You're the only one that's still alive out of that group.
I'm the only one standing.
Somebody sent us, this was one for y'all to sign today. Look at you here, which I don't know. When do you think that was, Jay?
I look dazed and confused. So does Phil. I think I'm probably 25 there. So
that's 25 years ago. That's you 25 years ago, Dad. You had just a little bit of, just the beginnings of a gray in there.
Yeah.
All I can say is I look at these old pictures and I keep the same refrain keeps coming to mind. Life has not been kind.
That's what I always say about when I see the pictures aside.
Yeah, it's so weird. We've done all these things, you know, back when we were duck hunting. The other day, somebody sent me, they listened to the podcast. And that's why I said we needed to come up with a name for these people. But they sent me two books, and I could tell it was an older gentleman because these books were like from 1940 something. And I'm the type of guy that I started reading them because I thought, because he said, I think you'll find these helpful. And I was really impressed. What they were basically about what I'm about, which is the point of the Bible being. Introducing you to Jesus, to someone you can actually relate to, instead of viewing the Bible as a rule book but what's funny is these two writers who were from basically born in the 20s, even though their jargon was, you know, it seemed like it was in that era, it was the same principle that we're hollering about. It makes you realize that, you know, no matter what generation you're in.
Nothing new under the sun.
Yeah, people get it. You know, I was like, well, this is good. But what's interesting is he had a card there, and he said, I'm from Nebraska, and I hunted on the Platte River in the same place you did where y'all shot the coyote. Well, you remember that. I'd forgotten about that story. And you remember what happened on that?
The coyote was sneaked up on us.
Yeah, because he thought Jep was our cameraman, which is my younger brother. And so we're real paranoid to the point of psychotic about a cameraman flaring the ducks. So Jep's over there next to a tree. He is the tree. You know, they used to wear those ghillie suits, and I mean, they're just moving slowly. Well, what I didn't know, what I found out later, the coyotes there in Nebraska, the river, the Platte River, is below. There's kind of an embankment, and we would get on top of it and build a blind.
Yep.
Of course, we're all in a blind. We're all concealed. Mm-hmm. And they get up there, and they jump down on the ducks. That's their move. Well, we're blowing duck calls. We're all hid. Well, the coyote hears the duck calls.
So he's thinking they're ducks.
But he comes
up. Which tells you how good your duck call is.
He thinks our decoys are ducks.
Yeah.
And so I turn around and look, because Jeff, I'm always monitoring in case they move, because you don't want to shoot. You know, you want to know where your safe shooting is. I turn around and look at Jeff, and I see a coyote in the predator position on Jeff, but he's behind. He slipped up on Jeff. I mean, he's literally just a few feet away. And but what cost him his life is when I looked at the coyote, he reared up, you know, like most wild animals, you know, when they see a human, they take off running. But
stood his ground.
He stood his ground and gave a growl. Well, I'm standing there with a shotgun. It didn't end well for him.
Don't stand your ground against the shotgun. That's not good.
Nope. It was literally like, you know, remember, and then he ran off. I thought, well, did I miss him? But he didn't run far. He went about 10 feet and he was dead. But that really happened. I mean, Jelp was just like terrified, because Jeff don't have a gun.
Yeah,
and there's a coyote
stalking him.
And don't
go to a coyote fight with a camera. You know,
right. And he was obviously, the more we inspected him, it was something wrong. He had something wrong with him. You know, but he was real poor. Look, I'm sure he had rabies or whatever. When you start attacking humans, I mean, that's not normal. But so we took him. We did a deed for society there, which, and I think even in Nebraska, most states, you know, they view coyotes as something that needs to be controlled.
Yeah.
Because they get out of hand, which is, it's not a pleasant thing, but you know, when you're attacked, you know the order of things that God instituted.
That's right.
You know, you have God, humans, and then you have animals, especially animals that are attacking humans. You take him out. And we did. But anyway, I thought that was interesting because I had forgotten that. He sent me a couple of books, so I appreciate that from Nebraska. They were really, really good.
I got to use one of my – I love using movie lines like in sermons and stuff. I mean, some of our favorite movies. And so Lisa's, you know, planning something, new painting on something. So there's this woman here. I don't know if this ever happened to you, Jay. So this woman's here, and they're talking about paint colors, and I just happened to walk by. And so she says, "Oh, Mr. Allen, do you want to weigh in on this paint color?" Which, so I figured out a long time ago, you have to find some way to dissuade this at the beginning of the project, or you're in every, they're trying to pull you into everything, whatever it is, furniture, you know, hey, look at this, what do you think? So this woman, so I
but
knew.
If you do that, Al, that's going to cause discomfort.
It will, unless you do it the right way. So here's how I did it. So you got to use some humor. So she said, do you want to weigh on this color? I said, have you ever seen the movie The Fugitive? Which stops a person in their tracks because she's asking about paint color, and I go right pivot. You ever seen the movie The Fugitive? She was like, yeah, I've seen that movie. So you remember when Dr. Kimball was he's about to jump off into the, you know, off into the dam,
yeah.
And Tommy Lee Jones, the marshal, standing there, and he's got the gun on him. And the fugitive says, I didn't kill my wife. And Tommy Lee Jones said, I don't care.
Yeah, that was a good
line. I said, that's how I feel about the paint color. And so they laughed, and I just walked away. So nobody got upset. It was just like I was able to use a good movie line.
I don't think my wife would like that. But she asked me, and then I go the George Costanza, whatever I think it should be, I say the opposite. And she goes, yeah, I like that. So that's just the way I function, because I don't care. I'm with you.
Well, my deal is if I ever get in the pool, I'm in then, because Lisa loves to just – and I realize she's
the
wanting –
the quarantine is causing a lot of that.
Is that what it is?
Because you're inside – look, my wife has painted the door.
We're painting the house. We're
did you notice doors. My door's a different color?
I said, why'd you paint
the door? She said, I mean, I don't want a red door. I said, well, you painted it the first time red. And she was just looking at me bewildered. I thought, now you're upset.
Like it's a bad thing. And you
want
did
a red
it.
Door. I was
that's,
like,
that's why what you're pontificating on is it's why there is, you know, domestic, not tranquil, there's domestic violence going upward the pandemic is
that is true.
Yeah. So look, so I
because you're sitting there arguing about what color the door is.
When we normally arguing, she just painted. But look, here's where I had the problem. Well, then 3 days later, I come through, and everything in my little space where I make the coffee, it's all not there. And I look, there's tape on the walls, and I thought, she's painting the walls now. And so I walked in there to the bedroom, and I said, are you fixed to paint the walls? She said, well, they match the door. I said, well, where is this going to stop? She's like, until we get all the red gone. I was like, but at one time
so
you liked
that. So she just moved on from red. I mean, red
she
used to
like,
be.
Well, I say it's red. It was, what was it, maroon? Or I don't even know what color that was. Yeah.
The seeds of domestic violence. So get into some Bible out. Where are we? John chapter 7. Let's talk Bible, boys.
The funny end of that story was I said, well, I guess I'll go clean the gutters. And she's, I was kidding. And she said, well, I was wondering when you were going to get around to it.
Here we go. This is how it happens. That's the raise in domestic.
The fruit of the pandemic.
I'll say this. We're in John 6. Jesus feeds the 5,000. One thing I wanted to say, reflecting on what we did Sunday, which I thought was excellent. When you read something like Jesus feeds the 5,000, you look at all that group, but you know, the way this kingdom stuff works and Jesus pursuing individuals that become a group of followers, which both they have their powerful moments, you realize, well, if I was one of the people there, you know, how would that affect me? And what y'all did for Mother's Day is you had a mother, Mindy, who's close to us all. You know, she gave her, I guess you would call it a testimony.
Kind of a mini testimony.
Yeah, but, well, you're talking about what a story. I mean, this girl, she starts off saying her mom was murdered, and then
a few weeks later, her
dad was convicted, and here she is, and they wind up at our church over this whole situation. That was my phone. And, you know, I remember being early 20s, I guess, right in the time of the picture you just showed there, thinking, wow, I mean, this girl.
Do you remember? Because we were both interns at the church.
Well, because I remember making the decision with Missy. I was like, there's a girl coming to our church now that her dad is on trial for shooting her mom.
And she's losing both parents. She's becoming an orphan.
She's losing both parents, and our grandparents were there. But I was like, we need to help this girl. And we just made a decision. I said, and Missy was like, what are we going to do? I said, we just need to be a friend. And so we did. And
she was about 16.
I used to go to her games, and, you know, she just, I don't know. She became a special person to me. And look, she made many bad decisions, and she shared that. Mm-hmm. But boy, you know, she the whole time she shared that about being a part of the body and about keep surrendering to Jesus despite what had happened. And she got down to the end and she's like, you know, because now it's been how many years now?
Oh, man, 25.
25 years. She's like, you know, people ask me, would I like to have a, you know, cup of coffee with my mom? She's like, yes, I think about that every day. But she said, would I take back anything that happened that turned me into the person I am today? And she went, absolutely not. I mean, when she said that, I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's powerful.
And so I think when you view something like this and you realize that Jesus is doing all these things, when you, at some point you got to apply it to you individually and realize, I mean, Jesus turns people's lives into powerful forces that influence the globe.
Yep.
And you, I mean, that one little, what was that, 3 minutes she
About
shared
five
that?
Minutes, yeah.
And it was like very articulate, very just.
Well, now
moving.
She speaks in women's prisons. And I mean, like, because she's amazing.
Just powerful. And just like, it was like, I love this woman. But, you know, I thought back to that Jesus moment she had despite her whole world crashing down. I was like, this is what this is about.
Yeah. Hang on, Dan. Let's take a quick break and then give us your thought. So nobody likes losing their hair. it's a problem for some guys, especially male pattern baldness is what they call it. It's a genetic.
Get over it.
Could you get over it?
Mine leaves. I'll get over it.
Well, when you're 74, maybe don't worry about it.
I
figure
it'll take a couple of days, you know. I'll be all right.
Yeah, you're happily married also. I think in the dating world, this stuff would be just
like.
Just
think about it if you're 25 years old, though, Dad, back in the day when you had the big mane of hair.
That's too far back to even bring up.
So for all of you young guys out there that want to hold on to your hair, it's probably important to you. We got a great company, Keeps, that has two FDA-approved hair loss products. You go to their website, you get an online consultation. They'll answer your questions. They evaluate everything. It's a great opportunity to get find out what they can do for you. They're going to ship it straight to your house. So it's keeps.com/door. So if you go to keeps.com/door, you get half off your first order, which is awesome because you heard it here first. So half off. Check it out, keeps.com/door.
One thing in John 6 and John 7, I think we need to keep at the forefront. When Jesus was talking about being the bread of life, he said our forefathers ate manna and died. Jesus is talking, John 6, about verse 38. Our forefathers ate manna and died, but he who feeds on this bread will live forever. Now, we've got a person making statements like that. You feed on me, you'll live forever. And if you go to John 7 right there at the beginning, Al, it said the Jews, John 7 verse 1, staying away from Judea, Jesus was staying away from it. You say, why? Because the Jews were waiting to take his life. So he's under the threat of being physically killed, which eventually he was. But another comes up in John 7. It said, has not Moses given you the law? Yet not one of you keeps the law. Why are you trying to kill me? So when Jesus is doing all these things in the book of John, it begins, in the beginning was the Word. He was with God. He was God. Through him, all things were created. So you got that person who is under a constant threat of death. The entire time he's talking to all these lessons and telling them the way they ought to be and what life is all about and immortality, he's the one that said, they're going to kill me. 3 days I'll be raised from the dead. He kept telling them that. When I'm lifted up, you know, mm-hmm. That's further on into John. I'm lifted up. Right. I bring all men to myself. So we don't need to forget that during all of these little sections of John or anywhere else you want to read, in the Gospels, he was always under the threat of death,
right?
Which is why he came. But he's trying to get all the information. That's why I think interesting text, in the fullness of time, Galatians 4:4, or when the time had fully come, the individual Jesus, why is it that the world, they all base time on the arrival of Jesus Christ? No matter what you want to say, atheist and all, everything back before he showed up, they still say in B.C., and they say, well, B.C.E., but you say, but he is the epicenter of time? You're like, everything after him, A.D.
Well, that's something they're constantly trying to change.
They're trying to change it, but they can't get around it.
It's still there, isn't it?
So if you look at it, you say, man, when the time had fully come, Galatians 4 says, God sent his son, that's John 1:1, born of a woman, that's John 1:14. Born under law, the law of Moses was still going on when he showed up, to redeem those under law, which was a gigantic proposal that we might receive the full rights of sons. And then he talks about the Spirit being given.
He does bring that up a lot.
So in the context of all of it, just remember, he was there to show them that they weren't good enough to keep the law of Moses. He had provided a way. He's full of grace and truth. There's a different agenda here, but you just look at the pressure one person was up on him. You just think about it, Al. I mean,
but he always, even that one you referenced in John 7:4, they told him, they said, no one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. You know, they were kind of rebuking him, saying, I mean, if you want to be some kind of public figure, we got to go to the masses, you know, do more miracles out. And Jesus said, well, it's not my time yet, because he was putting the process in motion, which would then become our process. Mm. I mean, that's why you think about a good thought is, why did Jesus go through the 33 years on the earth? Why didn't he just show up
fully grown?
What was the whole deal about the process?
Because, by the way, right after
really, the only way you can relate to your life, and I've said this in many speeches, but actually your life, once you surrender to Jesus, it becomes Jesus' life because he's in you. So what do? You live. You try to show how good God is. You try to help people with all these same principles. And then guess what? You die, you're buried, and you're raised. It's the exact same process.
It is. Plus, right after you quoted that, they said, since you're doing these things, show yourself to the world. What's your holdup? Not realizing what I mentioned earlier, time itself is predicated on him. Right. Did he ever show himself to the world? But they're saying, what are you doing running to the hills? You fed 5,000 people, you know, and we want to make you king. You're the man. And he went to the hills. But right after that, he says, even his own brothers did not believe in him. That's his family members. Yeah. They said, I don't know, you know. He's saying some.
I've used that many times.
He's saying some strange things. I don't know, but even they had their doubts. I mean, and his own family members, you look like that and said, hey, you know, he's our brother. We got to go with him.
If you want a good sermon, you read that John 7:5 where it says, even his own brothers didn't believe. Then you go to Acts 1:14 and following there, and it says his brothers were there in the room praying.
Yep.
So you're like, what happened? How did he win them over? Oh, yeah, there was this thing called the resurrection. Once you see your brother, you know, die, and then 3 days later you see him living again, you start going into rooms and praying.
They all got together then and said, we were him.
Well, I love the way that the Bible will tie up loose ends. You know, that the verse we talked about in chapter 6:15 said, and we talked about this last time, they intended to make him king by force, mm-hmm. which is then when he drew away. And it's interesting because Jesus is the last king of Israel. It was always pointed to that he would be the king, but not in the way they thought king, but
spiritual
kingdom. King from then
now,
on.
Forward. There are still people waiting today for the king to show up and whoop everybody.
He's already here.
I know it.
It's a physical understanding, which is why you have the backdrop of the 5,000 men. They're like, go public. We're going to have an army here. We have everything.
We're
going to
whoop them all.
This is the eternal kingdom that Daniel referred to in chapter 2 and chapter 7. Here, you've got this power of the gods, and we're going to whoop everybody. But that's why he would withdraw, because they didn't really understand that he's going to change people from the inside out.
But that's what I'm saying. So this is a type of a loose end, because it's interesting. The very first king of Israel, who was a man named Saul, didn't want to be king. And yet the people forced him to be king. He was tall.
That didn't turn out well.
It didn't turn out well at all. And it was interesting, because their first king, and God, you guess who told him this is not a good idea? God. He knew who the king he wanted. It was going to be David, who was in God's mind the first one. But the people are like, no, we want Saul. He's taller than everybody else. Saul was a terrible king. So I love the way that God sort of ties that up. You may have chosen your first king by force, but the last king, which will be me, you're not going to – it's not on your timetable, it's on mine. That's why, like you said, he kept slipping out, and he wasn't ready to do what he came to do.
Is they weren't really believing him anyway, because you, in your mind, even though they were seeing miracles, you're thinking, this is some kind of trick, you know, because it wasn't – that's not why God came to try to prove himself to you. He came down here to show us what his nature is, which is holiness and goodness. But people tend to think, oh, well, if I saw a miracle, you know, I'd follow God. Everybody that I've ever heard say that in a Bible study, they weren't living right. Because they're like, if I could see it, and I'd say, no, you wouldn't.
I'd start behaving then.
Yeah, I'd say, no, you wouldn't. And they're like, no, I would too. No, you wouldn't. Because in your mind, you would try to figure out why that didn't really happen. Even because that's what they did. They were missing the point. If you want to see a true supernatural happening in your life, get the Holy Spirit of God and start changing the way you operate. Plus, that's the power.
Any miracle that you ever could see every 15 minutes, if Jesus appeared in person to us right now as we're carrying on this conversation, he's here, but you say he's invisible. Well, what if he appeared and said, guys, let me tell you something. Keep up the good work. If he appeared right there 5 feet from us, Jesus himself.
6 feet.
Which he could do. 6 feet, social distancing. He stands up and he says, guys, keep up the good work. Tell him about me. And then he went, he's gone. I would look at you and you would look at me and Jace would look at me. I said, did you see that? Now, here's the point. Would it change one thing about him coming down, living a perfect life, dying on a cross, being buried? Would it change the resurrection of his body from the ground? You say, no. Well, if your faith's not tied to that, even if he appeared to you every 15 minutes and you say, now that was a miracle, would it change the fact that you'd have to put your faith in him and that he loves you and he died for you, he was buried and raised from the dead? Every miracle every 15 minutes, you say, I already believe.
But, Phil, the point is, would it change the way you live? Because when he said in John 7, what we were referring to, he says the world, because he said, my time hasn't come yet, in 7:7, the world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that what it does is evil. Well, the rub was, and the reason he was saying, well, wait, because that's what he was after. He was into transforming lives. Well, people don't want to do that.
Plus, look, you see all the miracles that he performed.
Hang on, let's take a quick break.
Hi, it's Jason Whitlock. Have you secured your spot for Roll Call 2.0, my annual men's summit in Nashville, Tennessee? Are you looking for an opportunity to fellowship with other believers, to come together across the identity lines the left have drawn to divide us? Join me, country music star John Rich, and Blaze founder Glenn Beck in Nashville on Saturday, June 1st for Roll Call 2.0. We're going to listen to great music, eat fantastic barbecue, and hear inspiring speeches from myself, Glenn Beck, North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, Pastor E.W. Jackson, and many more. Let's quit letting the satanic left sift us like wheat. Let's come together as men and talk about the sacrifices we must make to restore the unity and shared values that made our country the envy of the world. Visit FearlessArmyRollCall.com to secure your spot.
All the miracles that he performed, I mean, he fed 5,000. We're just looking at a couple of them here. He fed 5,000. He walked on water. Okay. You'd think, all right, okay, you got me. That's enough for me. No, didn't change them. You say, well, what about another one? Show me another one. He'd show him another one. Show me another one. He'd show him another one. You say, how come they didn't believe in him? How come they finally dragged him up the hill and put him on a cross? I thought if you saw a miracle, that would do it. He was performing miracles in front of them. How come it didn't work? So for the people, fast forward 2,000 years, if I could only, like you said, just see a miracle. They did. Well, how come they didn't say, okay, I'm all in. That did it for me.
Because they don't want to change your life.
There you go.
That's why Jesus went through the process, the whole process, in humility, and then he dies. Because you know what affects your life? When you think about Jesus on a cross dying for the sin that you're contemplating doing, then for the first moment in your life, you don't have to have God whisper in your ear, don't do this. He got on a cross, so you'd say, I don't need to do that.
Shun evil and embrace good. And you're like, you talking to me? You said, just shun evil and embrace good. Just be good. That's all he wants. Love your neighbor. Love him. They're like, well, I mean, there's more to it. Now you say, no.
What people miss about the people he was arguing about, these Pharisees and all. It wasn't so much their doctrine. It's that that was a cover up for what was going on in their life, which was a lot of evil, and that's why it threatened them, because they had it all worked out. And then all of a sudden, who do you think you are? What are you trying to say? Well, you're, and then they would even accuse him of being hooked up with demons and
well, because you got to remember, there's a certain group of people that were trying to kill him the whole time. The other people were trying to make him king. That was all going on in real time.
The world cannot hate you, but it hates me. Because John 7, verse 6 and 7, the world hates me because I testify that what it does is evil. He said, I'm testifying that what the world does is evil, and they hate me because of that. So, Jason, you're on to something when you say it.
That's what I'm saying. People, I've had so many discussions with people, and they have religious arguments about the pursuit of miracles, and I always, when that comes up, I always get into their life. I'm like, well, how's your life? Because I know what was behind Jesus's intention. At some point, Jesus is enough. He's better than the miracles, as I've said many times, because he has the capacity to do them. So if you want to see something supernatural happen in your life, because the hardest thing there is in life to do is change something in your life that's terrible, or you know, a bad habit, or you know, whatever it is, it's just hard to change it. I mean, people make New Year's resolutions every year, and guess what? Most of them don't work.
By the way, Al, and that goes to your point as far as who controls the agenda. They told him, they said, "You go to the feast. I'm not yet going up to this feast." Because for me, the right time has not yet come.
Yeah.
Having said this, he stayed in Galilee. You say, no, that's you're trying to make the agenda. I'm the one that makes the
agenda.
Every
time they would try it, he would do that.
Every time.
He was setting the stage. And that's the other thing about this, the miracle we're talking about the fish and the loaves, which we began last time. The question to ask is, why did he feed this anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 people, once we throw in the women and kids? And it's not because they were just hungry for the one meal. That at the surface, that's what it looks like. Oh, they're hungry. And he even threw that out there. You know, hey, we got these people. How are we going to feed them? And the disciples are like, what are you talking about? We couldn't even give them a bite of food. He did it to show who he was, because this is when he gets into later, the sustenance. He's like, oh, you want bread that'll last? Remember when we were talking about the woman at the well, and he did the same thing with her. She's thinking water.
When everybody can get all they want to eat and they're patting their belly,
that's right.
Where'd he go?
It's the guy we want to follow. He's going to feed us every day.
But it all led to that
free
one.
Free grub.
Led to the one statement in verse 35 when he said, I'm the bread of life.
That's right.
Everything that happened was for that one reason.
That's why he did the miracle. He did the miracle to show who he was. But the sustenance, but they're still not getting it. And we understand that because, like you said, you get hooked on the result. It's like, well, they came back the next day and they were like, and he says, only reason you're back here now is because you want another meal. Even said it out loud.
To this day in America, let's face it, boys, there's a lot of people who hate Jesus. They don't want you. They put their hands on their ears almost in this. I mean,
well,
they are bad.
They don't want to change their life. But there's also a lot of people who go to churches only for the blessings. They want blessings. I've had people who I've had bizarre conversations where they'll say, you know, they're not working, they're out of a job, and they're like, and I'm here, I am trying to share Jesus. You've been in these situations, and I'm like, look, you're in Jesus. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart. Not working for me, I'm working for the Lord. All the passages in Colossians, and I've had many times people will say, well, I gave, but I haven't got the blessings from that yet. And I'm like, no, wait a minute here. So you're giving money, so God will then give you more. That was why you gave? I was like, well, no wonder. You're not getting it. What are you? You're taking God's position and trying to make a deal. I mean, you give because it was his anyway. He's made everything. You give out of the heart. But what's that got to do with you? Because the hardest thing to do is now go to work. Because I know, you know, because they're like, well, if I could just see a sign like, and get a return from what I gave. And I'm like, this is the sign. I'm the sign. Go get a job in the name of Jesus.
A hard sell in America, man.
Let's take a quick break. So I told a story, Jason, when we preached this last Sunday about talking about prosperity, because we were in Psalm 128. And the idea, he says, your labor. I love that idea about work. And so I made the point that we were made to work. I mean, the very first guy, he's in the garden to do what? To work it, take care of it. Yeah. And he's from that.
Well, even Jesus kept referring to it in chapter 6 as I'm working here.
I'm working here.
God's been working.
So he's always working, and he created us to work. So what's interesting was I made the point, just looking back at my own family, looking at mom and dad. So mom and dad, when they were not Christians— and they, you know, were not too far out of college, but they had the most they had ever had, but neither were living for Christ, but financially had the most money you ever had, running a bar, a lot of money, cash, changing hands. And so you had a little stockpile of cash, but the prosperity was not felt at all because the life was terrible. I mean, there was no joy from that. So I was making the point that you can't, Jesus said that your life is not the abundance of your possession. Right after that, you both came to Christ. We moved down here on the river. Y'all had the least you'd ever had, probably That's going back correct. To college. And yet,
ground zero.
And yet, you were at peace. We had prosperity and wealth and relationships. We had people coming to Christ. We had a family that was finally whole again. So the point is, if you only put it into the amass of your bank account, what's in your driveway, whatever, the check you get from the government, if it's all based on that, you've missed the whole point of what true prosperity in life is all about.
I mean, he's literally making bread out of bread.
Yeah.
He's literally making more fish. And think of what he was trying to get them to see, all the things that happened in the Old Testament, which I'm sure they were familiar with those stories, of all, you know, what was the one that the ravens was
– Yeah, that was bread. Elijah. First Kings 17.
Yeah. What was he bringing them?
God just turned off the spigot, no rain, because he's trying to make a point to Ahab and Jezebel. But so Elijah is the prophet, and he basically goes and says, all right, we're fixing to go into a drought. They didn't know it was only going to be 3 years, but we'll let you know when we get some rain. Well, all of a sudden, you know, that brings on all these problems. So Elijah, they were going to kill him. So he goes and hides out in a little cave. And God has a raven, or several ravens, I guess, bringing him a hunk of meat and a hunk of bread twice a day, you know?
Why is that story in there? Because if you put your faith and trust in Jesus, you work hard, you realize that we're here to represent other people, God will provide.
Yeah.
If it's a raven
no doubt
dropping you a steak and shake.
Steak and bake.
I mean, I always, look, because as an outdoors person, when I see a story like that, because you know, we call them crows. I don't like crows. But
they're loud and annoying. Well,
they're predators, you know. Yeah. But I thought, you know, if God can get a dumb crow to bring me a steak and a roll, I mean, that's pretty stinking awesome.
But look, let me add it to that. So here's another thing that happens right after that. So everybody's in a drought. So Elijah comes up on this woman. She's a widow woman. And she and her son, and she's like, you know, he's like, I'm hungry. Can you fix me something? And she says, well, you know, me and my son are fixing to die. We got one meal. I got just enough flour and oil left for one cake. And we're going to eat that, and then we're going to die. I mean, because we're going to starve to death. This is a sad story.
Where was that at?
This is in 1 Kings 17. So it's amazing because I'm in the wrong 2 Kings 4.
I'm following. I remember these stories once you said.
So anyway, so but I love the story because he's like, okay, so fix me that. You know, your last meal, he's like, I thought about the faith of this woman. He said, fix me that, and I'll eat that. And then going forward until this is over, until we get rain, every day you go in there, you'll have oil and flour. Don't worry about it. It'll just show up. So this woman goes in there and makes her last meal. She prepares it for the prophet. He eats it. And then until the drought ends, 3 years later, every time she goes in there, that oil level that she poured out for the day before is back up to the mark again.
But then she also, in the 2 Corinthians 4, it says she filled up all the jars there and sold the jars.
Yeah, it's two different stories.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Well, where are you at?
I was in the right place at 1 Kings 17.
And then 2 Corinthians 4 is about the
2 Kings 4, yeah.
2 Kings 4, yeah.
A different prophet.
And then after that, you have the, how do you say that, Shunammite's son?
Yep.
And that's Elisha, who, it was all over. It says in verse 8, it was a well-to-do woman was there who urged him to stay for a meal. She was just being hospitable. So he stays, and so he's impressed that, I guess, because the well-to-do woman was hospitable, which is probably an unusual thing in our world,
right.
You know. And so he's like, what can I do for this woman? Because here's a man of God that's wanting to do anything. And she's like, well, I don't need anything. Well, he asked the guy who was there, and he says, well, she has no son, and her husband is old, which is kind of humorous as far as the husband being old. Well, Elijah said, well, call her. So he called her, and she stood in the doorway, and about this time next year, Elijah said, you will hold a son in your arms. So he wanted to do that for her, just for being hospitable.
That was her future, Jay. In that culture, if you didn't have a son, you had nobody to take care of you. I mean, women they weren't working. So if your husband died and you didn't have a son, you'd starve to death. That's why you see widows are in such need. That was the
So backdrop. She said, no, because don't mislead me. She said, because she didn't want expectations. She was just like, no,
I'm good.
Yeah. But he did it. Next year, you know, I don't know if it was, I mean, this was before the age of Viagra, you know, and all that. The Lord just moved in and said, here we go.
And, something stirred the guy.
Well, I know.
Hang on, Jay. Let's take a break and then you finish.
So the child grew, and one day he went out to his father. I mean, this story is so interesting. And he says, my head. So he had some kind of head injury, and he dies. Well, she takes his body and goes and finds Elijah and says, hey, I told you not to raise my expectations. You gave me a son, and now he's dead. And so, well, Elijah, he makes a statement here. He says, the Lord has hidden from me what this all means. And she stayed around there.
Which is funny. He said, I'm as surprised as you
are.
Yeah,
I'm like, I didn't have a part in this. I don't know what the Lord is doing here. So anyway, and he said, well, go back and lay this staff on his head, and we'll try that, because he prayed. And she's like, no, I'm not going anywhere till you go with me. So he eventually goes back. And what's so strange about this story, I mean, read it. It's like better than any kind of a fiction novel. But he goes up. Now, here's a dead, and he's prayed to God. Here's a dead boy that he's caused all this, because he brought the whole thing started from just being hospitable. Now we got a dead kid.
It started out as a thank you gift, yeah. And now we've gotten into all this.
And so he gets on top of the kid. It says, like, face to face. It's kind of like you're thinking this is where the idea of mouth to mouth resuscitation began. So he tries this and he prays to God. Well, nothing happens. That didn't work. See, he does it again. Well, then the kid comes to life. And so we're back going again. You know? But I read that thinking, what was the whole point of it? And the point is, it's the same principle. The Lord will provide.
Yeah.
You're going to win. Because I'm sure the kid grew up, and one day he actually did die.
Sure.
But if you believe and know that God is in control, these things that we view are problems are not problems. Then the next story was one I've heard you comment on, which was death in the pot. Just one story after another of taking created things, right, or taking things that we take for granted, and then the Lord, like, miraculously doing things. You remember?
They said there's death in this pot. Yeah. Meaning, this is bad stew here. It's kind of like that thing of biscuits you said I threw out. Yeah. I said, no.
There's death in them biscuits.
It's like the time when
they kind of reworked the recipe, and they said, okay, they ate it, and it was good.
That's what we needed the time we shot the blue-winged teal, because look.
Oh, man.
The ducks are what they eat. And so those blue-winged tail have a bad habit. Some of them, they'll go to sewage ponds, and then they'll come down here to us, and we'll shoot them. And feel, well, I was like, these things stink. And Phil's like, oh, no. You know how
we put enough garlic in them, we'll get it out of there.
All right. Yeah, it'll be all right. So he cooked them, you know, all day. Well, when I went in there and he's popped the lid, it literally caused a gag reflex.
I remember it.
I just started gagging. And Phil's like, no, no, it'd be all right. Look, Phil took one bite and he went, gee.
There's death in that pot.
There's death in what we needed at that moment, because God actually worked and correct the death in the pot, and they had a meal.
Well, as you go through this, Al, in this John 7, you start down through there. Some were saying he's a good man when the crowds come up there widespread. Jesus has slipped in among them. They don't know he's there. Others said he deceives the people, but nobody said anything public about him for fear of the Jews. So the Jews were amazed when he went up to the temple courts and began to teach. They said, how did this man get so much learning without having studied? They said, now, wait a minute. He's got all these answers, these biblical answers. How did he get that smart? Yeah.
He didn't go to the school of Gamaliel.
No, he didn't go to the preaching school or the seminary.
Google
that. How does he know all this stuff? Well, yeah. they got him all. But when Jesus started talking to him, guess what a bunch of them said? You're demon-possessed. Who's trying to kill you? He told them, he said, why are y'all trying to kill me? And they said, are you talking to us? He said, yeah. So they said, you're demon-possessed. Who's trying to kill you? We'll just be your friends. Well, as it turned out, it's just interesting that through all these studies,
well, what I wanted
it came to, down to who is Jesus.
That's right.
That's what I wanted to – look, I read all that
in 2 Corinthians. They went back and forth,
I read all that in 2 Kings 4 because the last story of 2 Kings 4, here was a man, he brought – the man of God, 20 loaves of barley, bread baked from the first ripe grain, along with some heads of new grain. Give it to the people to eat, Elijah said. And the guy says, well, how can I set this before 100 men? There's not enough. But Elijah answered, give it to the people to eat, for this is what the Lord says. They will eat and have some left over. Then he set it before them, and they ate and ate and ate and had some left over, according to the word of the Lord. I mean, you're going back. How many thousand years?
At least 2,000.
And then here comes Jesus. And when he made that statement, I am the bread of life, it was the same principle that he was laying the foundation here. You put your faith and trust in me. It may not be easy. It may be difficult, but I will provide.
Physical food is nothing for me. And not only that, I'll give you food that you'll live forever if you feed on that.
Well, and that goes back.
And they're all trying to figure out who he is.
And that's what you go back to your Hebrews 13:8. Jesus is saying, look, I was there then. I was the one providing. I was the one providing that temporary sustenance. That was me.
He was revealing that I am the creator. I'm a human.
This is just one man's writing. It's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They all tell the same story. And someone says, well, why would you repeat it with four different people on who he was, mm-hmm. what he said, what he did, what he's now doing, what he will do? You say, if all four of them wrote the same story, you say, how in the world could they go with this much detail and where he's going, who he talked to, what people are saying? It's impossible for him to concoct this story and be this close to all these events from one end to the other.
I think he did it so you wouldn't be impossible. So people wouldn't be arguing about what verse 17 says about, you know, verse chapter 3 and verse 6, and they're missing the point. Are you living like Jesus in your everyday walk of life? I mean, I think that was the point, and somehow or another, just like the miracles, people still missed it.
You know, you think a lot about it now. Not too much has changed. There's still people saying, man, I think he was a good man. That Jesus stuff. I mean, you know, there's some nut out there. It's the same arguments.
That's right. So next time we come back in John, we'll have him walking on some water. If he hadn't done enough now with what he's done, he's going to catch our fancy a little bit better. So we'll see you next time.
So we're so glad you guys were with us today. You can subscribe on iTunes or Spotify or YouTube or Facebook. And be sure and rate us on iTunes so that other people can know about the podcast.